Russia says its forces have practiced simulated nuclear-capable missile strikes hitting various targets during war games in the western enclave of Kaliningrad. Iran's foreign minister slams the illegal detention of an Iranian citizen in Sweden over alleged rights abuses, calling for his immediate release. Also in the headlines, the U.S. Navy says it has allowed over 200 sailors to leave the USS George Washington aircraft carrier after multiple deaths by suicide reported among the crew. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Russia's defense ministry says its forces have practiced simulated nuclear-capable missile strikes during war games in the western enclave of Kaliningrad. Now, the announcement came on the 70th day of Russia's war in Ukraine. The ministry said Russian forces practiced simulated electronic launches of nuclear-capable Iskander mobile ballistic missile systems. They also practice single and multiple strikes at targets, including missile systems, airfields, and protected infrastructure on Wednesday. Russia placed its nuclear forces on high alert shortly after its troops entered Ukraine on February 24. Putin has warned of a, quote, lightning fast retaliation if the West directly intervenes in the Ukraine conflict. Rick Sterling is an investigative journalist joining us from California. Rick, welcome. It sounds like a potentially dangerous escalation. How do you view these nuclear tests?
I wouldn't call them an escalation, but I would call them a warning to the West. The conflict in Ukraine is increasingly being seen and recognized as a proxy war, with Ukraine a platform for the United States and NATO to undermine and to attack Russia. President Biden has openly spoken of his wish to for regime change in Russia. So I think the Russians are just warning the West once again not to exacerbate the situation anymore.
Do you think they will take heed to that notice or that warning, Rick? Do you think that the West or NATO, the US in particular, and the UK will not directly intervene in the Ukraine conflict?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're definitely right that it's a dangerous situation here in the West. There's a lot of course, the United States as a country doesn't know war. The United States has taken war to other continents, to other countries, but there has not been a war in the mainland of the United States since the U.S. Civil War 140 years ago. So there's no recognition of the consequences of war on your homeland. So the situation is very dangerous. I'm counting on, and we're all counting on, cooler heads to prevail and to not escalate the situation. But politicians being what they are, there's a motivation in some ranks to keep escalating, keep exacerbating the situation. The Democrats are, things are not looking good for them. There's inflation at home. The pollings in the country are very bad, and we know from the past that sometimes you distract attention from problems at home by creating crises abroad. So it is a very dangerous situation, we need for cooler heads to prevail.
Right, Rick, you mentioned the Democrats there. There is this myth that it's like the Republicans are kind of the war party and the Democrats avoid any kind of war. But this, not for the first time during a Democratic era or term, that a Democratic rather term, we see a war break out. And could this have, we have not possibly reached this point if the United States had agreed to Russia's security guarantees or demands months before, you know, which it sent, Moscow sent months before the war even started.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Last November, Russia proposed peace treaties with the with NATO and the United States. They put them in black and white, and the crux of it was to stop encroaching on Russian space and to get a firm commitment that Ukraine would not become part of NATO. That was just cast aside by the United States and by NATO. And so it's that policy, which is not a new policy. It's been going on since the late 1990s. And when the expansion of NATO began in 1997, 98, and since then it's steadily progressed. And over the last, it was under the Obama administration that the coup in Ukraine, in Kiev, took place. And that was a critical time. And ever since then, it's been one thing, one step after another, so that although Ukraine is not a member of NATO officially, it's increasingly being treated as a member, receiving weapons, training, advisors, and all sorts of things. So I think it's in the face of that reality that Russia has taken the actions that we've seen.
Rick, thank you very much indeed for your time. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Rick Sterling, the investigative journalist, joining us live from California. Now, Russia says it will cease fire and open humanitarian corridors for civilians in Ukraine's besieged city of Mariupol for 3 days beginning Thursday. The corridors will be open during daytime to allow civilians trapped at the Azovstal steel plant to leave the facility. Moscow says civilians sheltering at the plant will be allowed to travel to Russia or Ukraine-controlled territory. The compound is the last stronghold of Ukrainian forces in the city. Heavy fighting reportedly broke out at the plant on Wednesday, but Moscow denied its troops were storming the site. Earlier, Russian forces attacked six railway stations used to transfer troops and foreign weapons to the eastern Donbass region. Ukraine says Russia has intensified its offensive in the east. Russia launched the war on Ukraine in late February. Turning to other news now, Iran's foreign minister slams the detention and trial of an Iranian citizen in Sweden of alleged rights abuses. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a phone call with his Swedish counterpart Ann Linde, called Hamid Nouri's detention illegal and demanded his immediate release. Nouri was arrested in 2019 on charges leveled against him by the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO. Swedish prosecutors have requested a life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations back in the 1980s. Hamid Nouri's family has told Press TV that he was humiliated. Well, he has been humiliated, beaten, and denied access, that is, to medical services during his detention and trial period. The MKO terror group is responsible for a larger number of deadly terrorist attacks against Iranian people and officials over the last 4 decades. Political commentator David Yagubian says Sweden has a track record of working in line with the U.S. interests.
This, Daniel, is just a classic show trial, and unfortunately the Swedish judicial system has been effectively weaponized by the United States and the UK to serve the interests of American and British imperialism. And I don't think that it's any coincidence, even though the cases are unrelated, that within 10 days of the arrest of Hamid Nouri, the Swedish government announced the end of its bogus rape case against Julian Assange. Its work in the interests of American and British imperialism done in regards to Julian Assange. And then, of course, in the context of what was going on in late 2019, that is, the maximum application of Trump administration maximum pressure, and the Trump administration turning to all sorts sorts of illegal, underhanded, and cowardly dealings, such as within just a month and a half, then the cowardly assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad. So it's a show trial. It's absurd. Even the origins of this case having come directly from the brain and office of the terrorist cult leader Meriam Rajavi in Tirana, serving the interests again of none other than the Mossad and the overall goals of British and American imperialism.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic has always laid emphasis on the unity and integrity of neighboring Iraq. Raisi made the comment in a phone call with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The Iranian president hoped Iraq's political process, which started with last year's parliamentary elections, would lead to the establishment of a strong government. The Sadrist movement, led by Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, won most parliamentary seats in the October elections. However, since then, divisions between political parties have hampered efforts made to form a new government. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has raised the alarm about the negative impact of unilateral sanctions on ordinary people of target countries. Majid Takht Ravanchi made the remarks in an address to the UN General Assembly's Committee on Information. Iran's envoy said unilateral sanctions prevent access to essential medical supplies by limiting access to foreign financial resources. He added that such measures are against principles of international humanitarian law and the UN Charter. Takht Ravanchi said unilateral sanctions weaken economic growth of target countries, causing great problems for them. Several countries, including Iran, have been hit by U.S. unilateral sanctions even during the COVID-19 pandemic. Prominent international rights groups say the sanctions deprive Iranian patients of life-saving medicines. Palestinian resistance movements have warned Israel against allowing flocks of settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. Hamas said Israel would be held accountable as it is playing with fire and dragging the region into an escalation. The group urged Palestinians to stop settlers from any act of aggression and vandalism at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Separately, the Islamic Jihad movement said the call for settlers to ascend to Al-Aqsa is equivalent to declaring a war against Palestinians and their sacred values. The warnings come after some right-wing Israeli groups called on settlers to assemble at the mosque's compound on Thursday. In recent weeks, the regime has intensified its violent attacks on Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, including Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely to hold Palestinians. The incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with the other apartheid practices of the Tel Aviv regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court.
in the past several weeks, we've seen an escalation in ongoing Zionist attacks, invasions of Al-Aqsa Mosque and many areas in Jerusalem. We've seen repeated invasions of Jenin. We've seen ongoing attacks on demonstrations, on Palestinians defending their land. And that's really in Palestine from the river to the sea. And in many of these cases, these attacks have been accompanied by the mass detention and arrests of Palestinians.
The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
And even though the Israeli occupation's illegitimate military courts convict Palestinians over 99% of the time, they don't even have to do that. Instead, simply by issuing a military order, they can throw any Palestinian behind bars without charge or trial for up to 6 months at a time in a way that's indefinitely renewable. And this is what Israeli administrative detention looks like.
Turning elsewhere, the U.S. Navy says it has allowed over 200 sailors to leave the USS George Washington aircraft carrier after multiple deaths by suicide among the crew. The sailors were moved to a naval facility while the aircraft carrier was on its way to Virginia for refueling and overhaul process. The move followed reported suicides on board, including three in April alone. It has prompted the Navy to launch a probe last year. The U.S. president announced a new plan to clamp down the risk of suicides among service members and veterans. The plan included a focus on improving safety by limiting their access to objects that could be used to cause self-harm. Pentagon statistics show 19 out of every 100,000 sailors died by suicide in 2020. The U.S. Army has the highest suicide rate at about 36%. Per 100,000 the same year. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Manhattan District Attorney is continuing to investigate former President Donald J. Trump, but knowledgeable people say charges are unlikely to occur in the foreseeable future, if ever. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Ben Protas, Jonah Bromwich, William Rashbaum, and Lana Nguyen. The piece is titled Likelihood of Trump indictment in Manhattan fades as grand jury wraps up. When some two dozen New Yorkers filed into a Manhattan courthouse this week to finish out their grand jury service, the case against a man who would have been the world's most prominent criminal defendant was no longer before them. That man, Donald Trump, was facing potential criminal charges from the grand jury this year over his business practices. But in the weeks since the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, stopped presenting evidence to the jurors about Donald Trump, new signs have emerged that the former president will not be indicted in Manhattan in the foreseeable future, if at all. At least three of the witnesses, once central to the case, have either not heard from the district attorney's office in months or have not been asked to testify, according to people with knowledge of the matter. In recent weeks, a prosecutor at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who played a key role in the investigation, has stopped focusing on a potential case against Donald Trump. Other people with knowledge of the inquiry have said, a move that followed the resignation earlier this year of two senior prosecutors leading the investigation. And the remaining prosecutors working on the Donald Trump investigation have abandoned the war room they used to prepare for their grand jury presentation early this year, the people said, leaving behind an expansive office suite and conference room on the 15th floor of the district attorney's office in Lower Manhattan. The grand jury's expiration at the end of the month does not preclude prosecutors from impaneling another jury. But the developments underscore the reduced possibility that Donald Trump will face charges under Alvin Bragg, who, along with several other prosecutors, had concerns about proving the case. Some people close to the inquiry believe that it will not result in an indictment for the former president unless a witness cooperates unexpectedly, a long shot in an investigation that has been running for more than 3 years. In recent weeks, Alvin Bragg's prosecutors have issued a few additional subpoenas that indicate they are continuing to investigate but have not found a new path to charging Donald Trump. The previous unreported subpoenas, people with knowledge of the matter have said, appear to focus on the same topic that has long been the subject of the investigation, whether Donald Trump falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. The subpoena suggests that, rather than pursuing a new theory of the case, Alvin Bragg is looking at additional entities that received Mr. Trump's financial statements as he sought loans and pursued other business, and that the prosecutors are seeking potential victims of the former president. One of the subpoenas went to a major financial institution that may have received Donald Trump's financial statements. A second subpoena, sent to the Trump Organization, largely followed up on an earlier demand to the company for records related to the value of its properties. And a third subpoena went to the New York City agency that tracks municipal vendors, including Donald Trump, who has done business with the city for years, operating a golf course in the Bronx and an ice rink in Central Park. In an interview this month, Alvin Bragg said that his prosecutors were interviewing new witnesses and looking at additional evidence. He declined to provide any details, citing grand jury secrecy law, but said that the inquiry must be allowed to run its course. "It's a work in progress," Alvin Bragg said, adding later, "We've got seasoned prosecutors working every day. It's not going to be on a timeline." but impaneling a new grand jury could create challenges for any potential case. Donald Trump's lawyers could argue, and a judge might agree, that prosecutors were inappropriately hunting for a more favorable group of jurors. It would also take time to prepare a new presentation of evidence and months to lay out a case to jurors. Alvin Bragg's office does not have unlimited time to charge Donald Trump. Witnesses could forget key information. Prosecutors would also face a deadline to file the charges within 5 years of any crimes being committed, though there are some exceptions that extend that deadline. And were Donald Trump to announce another presidential run, Alvin Bragg would be likely to face political pressure not to indict a leading contender for the White House. But even as the criminal investigation fades from public view, the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, appears poised to take action against Donald Trump as part of her inquiry into whether he falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. The same conduct at the center of the criminal investigation. At a court hearing on Monday, 25th of April, a lawyer from her office said that the Attorney General, Letitia James, would probably take action against the former president in the near future. Because her investigation is civil, Letitia James can bring a lawsuit, but not criminal charges. At that hearing, a judge held Donald Trump in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a subpoena for records from Letitia James. And on Friday, despite Donald Trump's lawyers having filed documents that they said brought him into compliance with the subpoena, the judge declined to withdraw the contempt order, which is costing Donald Trump $10,000 a day. Mr. Trump has long denied wrongdoing and accused Letitia James and Alvin Bragg, both of whom are black and Democrats, of being politically motivated racists. If he ultimately is sued or indicted, his lawyers would be likely to point towards the disclaimer that his financial statements were not audited by his accountants and that they were submitted to sophisticated financial institutions that conducted their own due diligence. Alvin Bragg's office is monitoring Letitia James's civil investigation for potential new leads, he has said. And Ms. James's office is participating in the district attorney's criminal investigation opened by Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus R. Vance Jr., more than 3 years ago. In December, Cyrus Vance directed the two senior prosecutors leading the criminal inquiry, Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, to present evidence to a grand jury with the goal of seeking an indictment of Donald Trump. But when Alvin Bragg took office this year, he and several of his aides raised concerns about the strength of the case, questioning whether they could prove that Donald Trump intended to break the law. Other prosecutors in the office had raised similar concerns, people with knowledge of the matter have said. In the final months of Cyrus Vance's tenure, three assistant district attorneys stopped working on the investigation, concerned about how rapidly it was proceeding and what they felt were gaps in the evidence against the former president. Alvin Bragg eventually decided to halt the grand jury presentation, prompting the departure of Kerry Dunn and of Mark Pomerantz, who stated in his resignation letter that he believed that Donald Trump was guilty of numerous felonies. Just weeks after their departure, Solomon Shinarok, one of the key prosecutors on the team, stopped investigating Donald Trump. Mr. Shinarok, who for years was the lead assistant district attorney in the investigation, pulled back in part because it appeared to be winding down, two of the people familiar with the inquiry have said. The Daily Beast first reported that Mr. Shinarok was no longer actively involved in the investigation. While Mr. Shinarok is not investigating Donald Trump, he's still working on a Trump-related case. In July, Manhattan prosecutors indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing him of a years-long tax evasion scheme. Mr. Shinrock is playing a central role in preparing for that trial, and given that role, is participating in meetings where the investigation into Donald Trump is discussed, a person with knowledge of the meetings have said. In the interview this month, Alvin Bragg said that no one had left the Trump team since Kerry Dunn and Mark Pomerantz. Asked this week to clarify his remarks, Alvin Bragg's spokeswoman stood by them, saying that there was one dedicated team working on the indicated tax case and the Trump investigation. The team is led by Susan Hoffinger, an experienced prosecutor from Alvin Bragg, appointed to lead the officer's investigations division. The spokeswoman, Danielle Filson, said in a statement that the team included lawyers who have worked on the case for years and skilled new prosecutors with decades of experience and fresh eyes. She declined to say how many prosecutors and other staff are assigned to the team investigating Donald Trump, but said it was actively probing unexplored avenues. In the early days of Alvin Bragg's tenure, the core members of the Trump team took over a 15th-floor conference room as they pushed ahead with the presentation of evidence about the former president to a grand jury. But since the resignations of Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, the team has abandoned that room. An indication, veterans of the office say that the case is not headed towards a grand jury anytime soon. The team members are now sitting in offices in the Major Economic Crimes Bureau.
Food for thought.
Salam, and since we are still basking in the blessings of Eid al-Fitr following the end of the fasting month of Ramadan, here is food for thought from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam of the Pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the divinely designated vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Indeed, the aid is for those whose fasting has been accepted by God and whose worship has been appreciated, and any day on which God has not been disobeyed is aid.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program, in which we try to talk about some of the latest movies and then criticize them based on the theme that we have in mind. Sitting along with me is Sayyid Abdullah and also Brother Hussein. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam. Glad to be here.
Welcome. Well, today we decided to work on a very nice movie by the name of Patriot's Day. It's a 2016 movie or produced in this year and directed by Peter Berg. And, of course, the story comes from the same person and based on a true event, if I'm not mistaken. And it's about two brothers, in fact, planting a bomb or planning to plant a bomb during the Boston Marathon. So they cause hell of a panic among people. And then an FBI agent, along with the police officers and forces, join forces and, let's say, investigate to find and defuse some of the bombs. Before we talk about this movie and the beginning of our critique of this movie with Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, let's take a short listen to a part of this movie or a trailer of this movie, and then we'll be back criticizing it.
It's terrorism. We'll take it.
Let's get an evidence grid started right over there.
Clock is ticking. The world is watching.
The suspect seen on the surveillance cameras. Two bombers.
We gotta find these guys before they do this to someone else.
We can't have our citizens on the streets with all these threats. Every inch of this city is getting searched. We're shutting it down.
A taxi picked up a guy matching White Hat's description. Could be he's on his way to New York.
Are there more bombs?
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program, in which we try to criticize the movies, not necessarily based on the movie artistic features, usually based on their themes, such as this one and the previous movie that we try to give a critique about. Today in this episode, we are trying to criticize the movie Patriot's Day. It's a 2016 movie and directed by Peter Berg. Before I ask you about how you like the movie, the Rotten Tomatoes holds an approval rating of 81% with the average of 6.9 out of 10. And then the Metacritic gives an average score of 69 out of 100 and cinema score an average grade of A plus on an A to F scale. Brother Hussein, let me start with you this time. How would you like the movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brother, I actually enjoyed this one. It was I quite liked it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like a documentary movie type of film, mm-hmm. and it had all that like movie Hollywood movie type of feel
yes.
to it. But also, it was a documentary based on like true events, right?
Yes.
Also had a lot of prominent actors, which was interesting to see.
Yes.
Mark Wahlberg being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, lots of action, lots of explosions, big
yes.
ones. I kind of like that. And one thing I noticed that was very interesting was the attention to detail.
Yes.
Which really made it, you know, a masterpiece.
All right. Thank you very much. Sayyid Abdullah, how did you like the movie? Did you, give it an approval or positive approval?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The movie was okay. I mean, nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was a little bit slow paced, you know, considering that they're trying to film a true event.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be like a drama added to extend the movie itself.
Yes.
Which kind of, I think, gave it a bit of, made it a bit slower, a more dramatic than what it should have, what it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, a thriller kind of events.
Yes.
So that's the kind of part that threw me off. Beside that, it was okay. It was watchable.
Nice. Okay, let's take a listen, in fact, to a part of this movie, Patriot's Day, produced in 2016, directed by Peter Berg, and we'll be back criticizing that part.
Well, I'm really excited that we're taking the day off tomorrow.
Mm.
But I think after my masterpiece pizza, we're going to have to go on a run at some point.
Tomorrow? No, yeah. Honey, there's three things you can do on Patriots Day. One's watch the marathon, the other one's run the marathon, and the third one is get down to Fenway and yell for those Red Sox.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. The movie that we are trying to criticize in this episode is Patriots Day. It's produced in 2016, directed by Peter Berg, starring many characters and good actors and actresses such as Mark Wahlberg, Kevin Bacon, John Goodman, J.K. Simmons, and Michelle Monaghan. Brother Hossein, in that part, we can't do anything else because there's this talk between the woman and, in fact, her husband about the Patriots Day.
Yeah.
And they are suggesting that, they can't do anything else except like to go and attend the marathon themselves, like in person, and see the event like face to face. And they can't watch it like, for example, on TV, or they can't do anything else basically, like except to pay close attention to this day and the marathon whatsoever. And we all know that, you know, there are some institutes or institutions which are like responsible for the culture of the society usually. So they know how to build the culture, especially we are talking about the movie industry.
Uh-huh.
And this is what the movie industry is all about in the first place, in addition to the money, of course, economy-wise. Despite that, you know, why is this event so important? Why do they want to highlight and make it so significant?
Well, I think it really goes back to its traditional roots in the city of Boston itself,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's a traditional thing. A lot of people do it. And
mm-hmm.
if you're living there,
yes.
well, you should actually go if you can, rather than staying at home watching it on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it's trying to promote that whole, you know, you are part of this community and you should participate in events like this.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, before again I ask Sayyid Abdullah a question, stay with us for another part of this movie, and then we'll be back criticizing this part of the movie, Patriots Day, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Yeah, but what about like Eric and Rafi and Brennan and those guys? I mean, those guys were our friends, so it's like...
Don't think about it. It doesn't matter.
Bro, I'm not pussing out or nothing. I'm not at all. I'm just thinking about, like, Martin Luther King and, like...
Martin Luther King was not a Muslim. He was a hypocrite. He was a fornicator.
Yeah, but I'm a fornicator.
You think that's funny?
No.
Come here.
What? What?
You're my brother. You understand that?
Yeah.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. In this episode, we were criticizing the movie Patriot's Day, produced in 2016, directed by Peter Berg. I promised you, my dear audience, to ask Sayyid Abdullah this question. You know, Sayyid Abdullah, in this part, the terrorists think they are the only ones saved. All right? If you pay close attention to what they are saying together, and these two brothers I'm talking about, right? And they are the only believers available, you know, on the earth, and others, they think of them as deviated or driven by Satan and the like, especially the Westerners, you know, and well, and corrupt, basically. So they decide to, especially the mastermind behind, I mean, the older brother, of course, is trying to convince his, like, a smaller brother, a younger brother, to kill the Westerners because of this, because they are corrupt and they are not, like, true believers, just like them. They are deviated, so they got to be killed. They got to be, like, wiped off the face of the earth. How do one become so radical in their idea and philosophy?
It's easy. Even when the brother said to him, he said something along, we have to kill all these fornicators. And the brother said to him, I'm a fornicator.
Yes.
And
yes.
He kind of, you know, he said to him, it's not a joke, right?
Yeah.
But the brother was serious. I'm like, I mean, it's a human nature to sin. Mm-hmm. I mean, to commit blasphemy is one thing. To commit a sin is another. Now, being radicalized is an easy job, sadly, especially these days. It's easy to format and program people, especially those who don't have a background themselves, like in, let's say, in theology or in at least Islamic theology, since these guys are claimed to be Muslims. So we in Islam, and this is like a very dangerous thing, we have such slogans in terms of killing other people, they're very powerful and very motivating too, right? So you can take chapters or verses from the Quran, or verses from the Hadith, where Allah talks about, or the Prophet talks about, killing the infidels and the rewards for it, and it's empowering for those who don't understand the context of it, right? For example, we have many verses in the Quran.
You mean they are open to interpretation and twist and turn, right?
Not just open to interpretation, because if you just take a verse itself and by itself without understanding the context of it,
the literal meaning
is very dangerous.
Yes.
Right? Especially if you believe in Allah, and we have, like, we have sort of blind belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We don't question Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, unlike other religions. We don't question. So when you throw a verse at me, and if you have a way of getting that verse to me, it just like, it's like putting fire on oil or on petrol. It just lights up. So like I said, we have so many verses in the Quran about killing infidels and jihad, but all these verses were to specific events. It wasn't general. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala never in the Quran allows people to kill innocent people. So if you take each verse itself and you look at the context of it, you look at the event, you see it talks about something else. But if you take it by itself and give it to someone who doesn't know anything, that will just not just radicalize them, it just makes them like, you know, like a ticking bomb. And this is what we see.
It's so easy to be distorted.
So for any Muslim who believes in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and has that blind faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's very easy to program them. So, and all these terrorists and all these masterminds, they know how to work with the youth.
I see.
It's easy to pinpoint the problems of the West.
Yes.
And the mistakes of the West and the sins of the West and show them what Allah wants on earth. And they say, they're like, okay, now I have a duty. It's no longer like a matter of choice. It's a duty. I need to purify earth from all these infidels. So it's very easy. All you have to do is just pick verses and throw them at people. And that's it.
it comes from basically what you're saying, the ignorance of those people.
Obviously. Yes. Not just ignorance. So ignorance is one part. Yes. The other part is their devotion to the religion itself.
Uh-huh.
So they are so, when it comes to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and believing in Allah, they are so devoted to Allah
right.
and to the cause of Allah subhanahu mm-hmm. wa ta'ala. They mm-hmm. want to do something.
I see.
So okay. when a wrong person comes along, so ignorance and the devotion, they come hand in hand and you have a bomb.
Yes, I see. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein, for your nice contribution to this program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We tried in this episode to criticize the movie Patriot's Day, produced in 2016, directed by Peter Berg. And we hope to continue criticizing this movie in the upcoming episodes. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
What I saw today, good versus evil, love versus hate, there's only one weapon you have to fight back with. It's love. Wrap our arms around each other. I don't think there's any way that they could ever win.
NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was established in 1949 to organize political and military support between the United States and a group of European nations in order to deter and, if necessary, defeat the Soviet Union. After the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO gradually morphed into an instrument through which the capitalist class of North America and Europe seeks to impose its political will on the rest of the world, mostly via military operations.
I've come here to express the United States' steadfast commitment to that alliance, which has been the cornerstone of peace, prosperity, stability for the transatlantic community for more than 70 years.
Over the past decades, the organization has waged wars on a number of countries, all in the name of democracy and peace, most of them both illegal and unsuccessful. Libya and the 2011 NATO intervention there have become synonymous with failure and disaster. The intervention didn't produce anything resembling a stable democracy. Instead, it led to utter chaos, violence, instability, and civil war.
I cannot be sure there have been no civilian casualties. What I can be sure of is that we are very, very precise and discriminate in our targeting. There have been more instances than I can think of in the conduct of this campaign where our pilots have made the correct decision to not attack a legitimate military target for concern of the civilian casualties that attack would have caused. It is a very, very high priority, and I cannot emphasize enough the precision with which we conduct these strikes.
While political entities in the West were quick to celebrate the intervention in Libya as a success, the NATO campaign caused many civilian deaths and destroyed the nation's infrastructure. Moreover, the following instability unleashed an array of militias and terrorist groups that put the whole region in danger. As for Libya, NATO has failed in yet another sense. Tensions between Turkey and France as two state members of NATO over supporting different sides in Libya is a case in point.
In Libya, we are supporting the legitimate government, and the French government is supporting an illegitimate warlord and jeopardizing, as I said, NATO security, Mediterranean security, North African security, Libya's political stability. And I'm giving all this. They still blame us. They still criticize us.
Meanwhile, France considers Turkey as a non-conformist member of NATO. But Libya is not the only debacle in the recent history of NATO. After an easy military campaign in 2001 that drove the Taliban from power, ensuring stability and rebuilding Afghanistan's political and economic foundation proved challenging tasks for the transatlantic community. Despite having tens of thousands of soldiers from member countries of NATO in Afghanistan for two decades, the Taliban finally took over the country, another blow to the so-called biggest military alliance in the world.
When we made the decision, we all knew the risks. We all knew that entailed risks, also the risk of Taliban returning, though no one anticipated that this should happen so fast, the rapid return of Taliban. But we also knew that the alternative to end our military presence also entailed risks.
NATO's European members did not anticipate that involvement in Afghanistan would be a long war. The European members thought it would be a low-cost demonstration of solidarity and sympathy with American people, rather than a protracted operational commitment. According to one assessment, European politicians declared that Afghanistan was vital to their own security, but in practice continued to treat it as an American responsibility. In the context of a faltering campaign, the upshot was evaporating public support and mutual transatlantic disillusionment. Despite a two-decade occupation, NATO failed to bring peace and security to Afghanistan. A few months ago, the British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace pointed out that NATO was a political failure in Afghanistan. While NATO claims to be promoting peace across the world, the recent case of Ukraine reveals the opposite. By poking Russia through its expansionism, NATO is certainly more than an innocent bystander in the current Ukraine-Russia escalation. Not only has the organization failed in promoting peace, NATO has almost been standing by and doing nothing in the wake of this conflict, a stab in the back for the Ukrainians. In late February, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused NATO and the European Union of failing to take a determined stance on the Russian attack on Ukraine. The fact is, NATO's response to Russia's current actions does not mirror its response to Russia during the Cold War. The inaction has prompted Kyiv to reconsider its attempt to join NATO. This hesitation to get directly involved in the Ukraine-Russia conflict comes after a series of defeats NATO suffered in Afghanistan and Libya. It seems that the organization is unable to fulfill even its original mission, i.e., to deter the Russian bear.